morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today is the sixth day of the sixth month of the 19th year of the 21st century and third millennium, and it is an epochal day in the history of human affairs, especially its penchant to war upon itself, and might continue in collective memory until the finale of the sixth extinction. Today is the 75th anniversary of what might be considered the high water mark of World War II, which ended with nuclear bombings of two Japanese cities. Today is D-Day, the most famous amphibious invasion since at least 1066, but in exactly from the opposite direction across the English Channel. And today completes a troika of programs absorbed by war that I began with the commercially degraded Memorial Day weekend and continued on the real Memorial Day last week on May 30th. So today, June 6th, 1944, the real D-Day, not yet corrupted into a three-day holiday to flaunt plastic G.I. Joes. And I must probably give the fact that I wrote it, so it's my opinion and perhaps my opinion only in all of the universes, multiple universes. D-Day 75. Probably everybody who is able to read, write, or cogitate knows that World War II was enormous, that it was, in the words of the late war historian John Keegan, the largest event in the history of humanity, and that no populated continent was untouched by that near descent into absolute Armageddon, the final totally destructive battle. An estimated 50 million, perhaps even 60 or more millions of human beings perished out of existence during the 6 years the war spread over most of the world's land, sea, and sky. Though combatants died by the millions, many millions more civilians, multiple generations of them, were killed in massive bombing raids that destroyed cities or were exterminated in death camps as a result of their religion, race, or political beliefs. The immensity of death and broken lives, which will never be counted with complete accuracy, were approximately 15 million battle dead and missing, 35 million military and civilian wounded, 28 million homeless, 35 million imprisoned, which included slave labor and crematorium removal, 5 million orphaned, and 11 million plus executed. Exterminated might also be a word to describe genocide. World War II was the key stimulus to unparalleled economic and industrial mobilization to fuel its insatiable destructive nature. And it was a clash of ideologies on a scale not experienced since the Crusades of the first centuries of the previous millennium. It was, in essence, the second millennium's blood-stained climax and vortex of the nuclear age. World War II was allies against Axis, liberal democracy versus Nazi fascism, with one major exception, communist Russia, which was associated with both sides, initially the Axis until invaded by Nazi Germany, then the Allies as one of the big three that destroyed the thousand-year Reich of Nazi Germany, and as a late entry into the Pacific War against Imperial Japan. Although Russia suffered the brunt of Nazi wrath, 20 to 27 million dead, both civilian and military, in the war, which they called the Great Patriotic War, Britain and the United States, which were the other two major forces of the Allied triad, ranged over most of the rest of the world of the war's geography against Germany and Japan. World War II was particularly extraordinary for its large and costly amphibious campaigns in both major oceans, the Pacific and Atlantic, and in the Mediterranean, primarily by the English-speaking peoples, in Winston Churchill's vocabulary, Britain and America. Historian Ronald H. Spector, a Vietnam veteran, wrote that never before had such great armies been projected across hundreds, even thousands of miles of oceans to land on hostile shores, supported only by air cover and warships, which were themselves huge fleets, armadas even, of sea and air. The savage head-on American assaults upon Japanese-held islands in the Pacific have been described as one army of huge insects crawling ashore from the ocean in large metal monsters to obliterate without mercy or pity a defending insect army that it resisted in hopeless suicidal fury. The most stupendous amphibious invasion of World War II, codenamed Operation Overlord, was that upon the beaches of Normandy, which is being commemorated today, 75 years later, the glorified signature assault upon Hitler's fortress Europa that ended in total victory nearly a year later with the defeat of Nazi Germany, and which has made D-Day, June 6, 1944, one of the most significant dates in the history of warfare. The immortal war correspondent Ernie Pyle, whose concern for the common soldiers was the basis of his renown, described the vast carnage of D-Day when he went ashore at Omaha Beach, where the worst fighting had occurred a few days afterward. He wrote that sufficient men and machinery for a small war were gone forever. Most bodies had been cleared off the beach before Pyle arrived, but the litter remained. It extended in a thin little line, just like a high water mark for miles along the beach, he wrote. This was the strewn personal gear that would never be needed again. There were shoes and socks and shoe polish, sewing kits, diaries, Bibles, and hand grenades. There were the latest letters from home, with the address on each one razored out as a security precaution, Pyle wrote. There were snapshots of families back home staring up at you from the sand. There were pocketbooks, metal mirrors, extra trousers, and bloody, abandoned boots and shoes. There were torn pistol belts and canvas water buckets, first aid kits, and jumbled heaps of life belts. There were broken handled shovels and portable radios smashed almost beyond recognition, and mine detectors twisted and ruined. Two of the most dominant items on the beach refuse, Pyle wrote, were cigarettes and writing paper. Each soldier was issued a carton of cigarettes just before he started for the beach. That day, those cartons by the thousands, water-soaked and spilled out, marked the line of our first savage blow against Nazi-occupied Europe. Pyle also described the wreckage, which was vast and startling. The awful waste and destruction of war, even aside from human life, has always been one of its outstanding features of those who are in it. And Pyle wrote of knocked-out tanks, burnt jeeps. For a mile out from the beach, there were scores of tanks and trucks and boats that were not visible because they were at the bottom of the water. The strong, swirling tides of the Normandy coastline shifted the contours of the sandy beach as they moved in and out, Pyle wrote. They carried soldiers' bodies out to sea, and later they returned them. They covered the corpses with sand, and then in their whims they uncovered them. Ernie Pyle was killed during the invasion of Okinawa the following year, the last amphibious assault of World War II, which was made on Easter Sunday, 1945, which was also April Fool's Day. Although most counts of Allied casualties on D-Day are contradictory, essentially close to 5,000 were killed, missing, or wounded, U.S., Canadian, and British, and German casualties are considered inexact and vary between 4,000 to 9,000 casualties on D-Day. Most accounts of D-Day seldom mention French civilians who were killed or injured by the bombing campaigns before and after D-Day, and by artillery barrages from both sides following the landings. It was a profoundly traumatic experience for the people of Normandy, Christoph Pyle wrote. Think of the hundreds of tons of bombs destroying entire cities and wiping out families. But he wrote that the suffering of civilians was masked for many years by the overriding image of French welcoming the liberators with open arms, quote unquote. Next year, 2020, will be 75 years that World War II itself will have ended. Perhaps the celebrations will be less for the end of that war and more tentative gratitude mixed with cautious relief that there has not been a World War III in the three-quarters of a century that has passed since then, and that the half-century nuclear arms race that threatens once again to be revived has not yet obliterated humanity. Perhaps the past can be dismissed as irrelevant, even as empty nostalgia. But we are incapable of living outside history. We are what we are as a result of history, and human history is percolated with wars. Looking at history through only the bloody prism of war is to miss much of the best of it and distorts it. Yet wars shape nations and individuals. The only real significance of the eternal conflicts of our species is the epic flow of blood, the slaughter of millions at each turn of history's gory pages for reasons as brief as their lives. There is no good war and no bad peace, Benjamin Franklin said. But peace is also defined as a period between wars, a time to bury the dead, lick wounds, produce more and newer weapons, sow newer crops of human fodder. It is difficult to separate peace from its evil twin war, not unlike concentrating on yang without including yin. Nearly everyone professes hatred for warfare, but the inescapable reality is that humanity is a savagely warlike and intemperate species whose penchant for cleverly organized violence has made it supreme on Earth. Throughout human history, the killers have been the most honored, and as people have become more settled and civilized, the laurels transferred from the stealthy hunters of animals to the slayers of other human beings. All the great civilizations and empires have been structured on the expenditure of human blood, the conquest, and often decimation of tribes, cities, and nations unlucky to be along the march of more ambitiously militant societies. Every war can be traced back centuries, a vengeful antipathy underneath a contemporary surface of conflict, not surprisingly religious generally at its root. The most devastating and never forgiven wars are religiously based, holy wars, crusades, jihads, whatever they may be called. And it seems that every century has explosive recurrences among the same theolytical combatants. The cusps of millenniums seem to stir apocalyptic prophecies to greater carnage to obliterate opposing theologies. The advent of the last millennium sparked holy crusades that lasted three centuries and never really ceased, leaking catastrophically into this brand new millennium with a surprise and gruesomely deadly assault on the foremost temples of Christian capitals by radical Islamists. 9/11/2001. Although Americans conceptualize themselves as a peaceable libertarian society, it is among history's most aggressively ideological, inspired by a credo of manifest destiny based on its ideals of liberty and equality, but more truthfully on monotheistic racialism and hegemony. The American nation was conceived by revolution, preserved its union with civil war, became a continental power by invading Mexico and lopping off its head, and acquired world power, seizing the feeble remnants of Spain's decrepit colonial empire, which by then was constricted to islands in various oceans. The USA became a world superpower by fighting two world wars in which it built a military machine unsurpassed in history while demonstrating a production capacity that overwhelmed allies and enemies alike. It also had the good fortune that while most of the combatant nations suffered hideous destruction, neither war touched the USA's home soil. The United States has fought at least a dozen major wars, which does not include the incessantly pernicious and pervasive three-century war against Native Americans that is comparably among the most savage and genocidal ever fought. Expansion across the North American continent inflamed the xenophobic conceit of manifest destiny, which necessitated in the minds of the expansionists the continual extermination of the primeval tribes whose resistance against extinction was no match for the weapons of the Industrial Revolution and the baneful determination to possess their homelands. Of all the wars that have embroiled America, none have been as psychologically harmful as the half-century Cold War against Communist Russia and the mutually assured destruction that threatened the extinction of humanity with the advent of nuclear weaponry. Even now, with continued threats of a renewed nuclear arms race that traumatized the human spirit nearly a generation ago, a persistent subliminal dread of nuclear holocaust psychically rips away a fanciful illusion of undisturbed human continuity. Humanity seems caught between possible extinctions, a slow burn of climate change, or an immediacy of nuclear annihilation, each human-caused. History's dark glare shines on an earth too fragile for the titanic clashes of the past, yet human antipathy remains. Militarism rules the planet. Military values are taught at every level of education and are incorporated in the root systems of societal values. Militarism is the antithesis of liberty and democracy, and its justice is based on obedience and servitude. The economies of most nations are plowed into war machines that posture as defensive necessities, and world leaders blackmail their populations with fear and despotic populism, hostaging their lives and their children's futures, their wealth and liberties, if they possess either, to the gross cravings and deadly illusions of military power. Military castes have been as irresponsible as priests in exhorting doom. They speak of themselves as guardians of peace, but prepare the methods for the final combat, which is, after all, the shrine of their profession. Armageddon is the place for the last battle at the end of the world. Almost all religions and myths prophesize a final conflict or cataclysm that will terminate human life, and our history has propelled us to the savage frontier of our most primitive fears. That was something that I wrote, D-Day 75. And now, from the British side of things, by the British writer, Gary Yonge. Our glorious past is what we remember. The brutality behind it, we have forgotten. Immediately after the Second World War, German people were required to watch documentaries about the horrors of the concentration camps before they could get their ration cards. But the fact that they went, Tony Jute paints out in his book Post-War, didn't mean they actually watched. In the half-light of the projector, I could see that most people turned their faces away after the beginning of the film and stayed that way until the film was over, wrote the German author Stephen Hermlin, many years later. Today, I think that turned away face was indeed the attitude of many millions. As a German government official surveying the 20% rise in anti-Semitic hate crimes in his country advises Jews not to assume they can wear the kippah everywhere all the time in Germany, quote-unquote, and an Italian far-right party tops the poll for the European Parliament, we would do well to reflect on the corrosive impact of such determined forgetting. These memories need to be recovered not only to honor those who have perished or suffered, only to find their experiences discounted and discarded. It is crucial for the moral potential and political vitality of the perpetrators, too. It is also not possible to deliberately forget the terrible things you have done and then expect to proceed as though they did not happen and nobody noticed just because you have chosen not to remember. Unchecked and uncorrected for the sake of convenience and comity, these heavily redacted tales of how we got here and who we are return as slogans on baseball caps and billboards. If you have no idea what greatness means or how it was acquired, then of course you want to make America great again or put the great back into Great Britain. As such, the battle against intolerance, prejudice, xenophobia, and the manufacture of distrust and disunity, which Gordon Brown has described on these pages of The Guardian, is not a new battle for Britain. It's actually the same battle that has been fought over decades. It is important to understand that people of all races have resisted bigotry in this country. It is no less important to understand that they have not simply been combating bad people, but a bad system, that they have not always won, and that this system still exists. To the essential characteristic of a nation that is that individuals must have many things in common, wrote the French philosopher Ernest Renan, and must have forgotten many things as well. But they do not forget passively or at random. Things do not simply slip our mind. They are actually willfully, determinedly, selectively, purposely buried. The issue is not one of time. When needs be, we can reach all the way back to 1066, the last time Britain was invaded, to make sense of who we are and what we do. But somehow the atrocities in the Kenyan detention camps in the 1950s, our complicity in the Bengal famine in 1943, or even more recently, the Iraq War, eludes us. Our collective sense of responsibility for and engagement in these moments is similarly fickle. People say, "We won the war," even if they didn't fight, or "We won the World Cup," even if they didn't play. Indeed, one needn't even have been born to identify with the triumph in question. The "we" is implicitly understood as an embrace. It spans time, place, and agency. But few will ever say in a similar vein, "We raped people," or "We massacred people." For them, "we" is understood as an accusation. In these moments, individuality becomes the ultimate alibi. What has that got to do with me? I wasn't even alive then. Even when these atrocities occurred relatively recently, individuals insist on implausible deniability. When interviewing perpetrators of the Rwandan genocide, Jean Hatzfeld noticed the men would not admit to participating until the line of questioning shifted from the informal, singular, to the plural, formal, zu. Although each one is willing to recount on his own his experience of the genocide, he noted, they all feel the need to hide behind a more diluted syntax. And so it is that power and glory has many parents, while the brutality it takes to acquire and sustain it generally remains an orphan. My great fear is that we are all suffering from amnesia, the Uruguayan writer Eduardo Galeano once told me. Who, I asked, is responsible? It's not a person, he explained. It's a system of power that is always deciding in the name of humanity who deserves to be remembered and who deserves to be forgotten. That system has been working overtime recently on both sides of the Atlantic, where both nations move to exonerate war crimes or criminals. 2 weeks ago, the British Defense Minister, Penny Mordaunt, pledged to effectively place a 10-year statute of limitations on crimes committed by soldiers at war, with the exception of Northern Ireland. This would introduce an amnesty for veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars who may have committed war crimes. She also advocates opting out of the European Convention on Human Rights in future armed conflicts. Prosecutions of cases more than 10 years old would only be allowed in exceptional circumstances, where compelling new evidence has emerged. One would have thought that killing and torturing innocent civilians in a foreign land you have illegally invaded would be compelling enough. Apparently, the courts will be looking for something a bit more exceptional than that. Early in May, in the United States, meanwhile, Donald Trump pardoned Michael Behena, the soldier convicted of murdering Ali Mansour, an Iraqi detainee, in 2004. Mansour was arrested and bound and blindfolded as he was questioned about planting an improvised bomb that killed two of Behena's platoon. On Mansour's release, Behena was supposed to take him home, but instead took him to a secluded area, stripped him naked, and shot him dead, later claiming Mansour had made a lunge for his gun. Behena had already been treated incredibly leniently. His original 25-year sentence was reduced to 15 on review, and then he was released on parole after 5 years. Not bad for a cold-blooded murder. But that wasn't enough for Trump. White House spokesman Sarah Sanders said he had been a model prisoner. Mike Hunter, the Attorney General of Oklahoma, where Behena lives, said, "My hope is that Michael and the rest of his family can rest easy this evening, knowing they can put this tragic situation behind them." One can only assume that Mansour's family are not sleeping quite so soundly. Amnesia is the privilege of the powerful. But one way or another, we all must live and die with the consequences. And that was "Our Glorious Past is What We Remember. The Brutality Behind It We Have Forgotten" by Gary Yonge, who is a Guardian columnist and wrote this for The Guardian. This is Michael McCusker. 100 years ago this past Tuesday, on June 4th, 1919, the United States Senate passed the 19th Amendment with just 2 votes to spare, 56-25, over the required two-thirds majority. Drafted by Susan B. Anthony and first introduced in 1878 with the same wording, called the Anthony Amendment, women's right to vote was sent on this date for the ratification by the states and was made into law on August 26, 1920. The House of Representatives had passed the suffrage amendment 304-89 on May 21, 1919. And in regard to Father's Day, the Sunday after next, I think of the double entendre of my own personal D-Days when I received my school report cards. Happy 85th birthday, Donald Duck, who was born June 9th, 1934.